Welcome to the Sliders and Curveballs podcast. My name is Mike, and I'm here with my son, Joseph.
Together, we are learning sports one game at a time.
Boston Red Sox Hall of Famer Ted Williams once said, "All I want out of life is that when I walk down the street, people will say, 'There goes the greatest hitter who ever lived.'" Did Mr. Williams' wish come true?
Happy spring, everybody, and happy baseball season. You're in for a real treat today, sports fans, especially Red Sox Nation. You've heard our guest on NESN, the radio, and TV in New England for over 35 years. Plus, you've enjoyed his great articles on masslive.com. His book is called The Franchise, a curated history of the Boston Red Sox, with the foreword written by Big Poppy. Welcome to our show, author Sean McAdam.
Thanks for having me, guys. Happy to be with you today.
Well, thank you so much.
Hi, Sean. Happy baseball season to you.
Same to you.
And one thing I wanted to say, Sean, is I read that you're a PC grad, so I'm an alum of Johnson & Wales University. It turns out that we've probably walked on some of the same streets back in the day in our college days of Rhode Island. I was there in like the 1990 to 94 area where the downtown really wasn't much of anything. I would go to PC games once in a while because I'm a big UConn fan, so it was fun to watch the rivalry down on Thayer Street to have food. What do you remember of your college experience over there?
Yeah, I'm about a decade ahead of you. So I graduated class of 81 at PC. It was a terrific experience. Thought I got a great education at Providence College and remain a proud alum. Had a lot of fun times during school, met a lot of people who are still friends, and even had my daughter go to PC some 30 years after I left. So it's in the family blood.
Absolutely. Well, so we're going to concentrate entirely, although we love to talk our basketball, and UConn certainly has a lot to celebrate right now. We're going to talk primarily baseball today, right, Joe? So you want to kick us off with our first pitch for Sean?
I wanted to start by asking your opinion of the team. Having spent time covering them for spring training in Fort Myers, yes, we have Devers and pitcher Brian Bayo, but do we have any playoff potential this season?
Well, that might be a stretch, Joe, even though they're off to a great start through the first five games as we record this. They're 3-2. I think it's been encouraging that the starting pitching has been as good as it's been through the first series plus. Excuse me. But there are definitely some holes, and it's clear that this is a season in which the Red Sox are trying to build towards something. They obviously did not have a very fruitful or active offseason. I know a lot of people wanted them to do more in free agency. They really only signed two free agents all winter, and one of those, of course, Lucas Giolito, was out for the year with an elbow injury, so that's a significant loss. But I think we can start to see a little bit of what's coming in the pipeline, both in terms of position players and pitchers. You're seeing pitchers who've had some major league experience over the last two or three years, people like Cutter Crawford, Tanner Houck, Garrett Whitlock. If the first time through the rotation is any measure, then they've made some improvements, and it looks like the pitching program instituted by both Craig Breslow and new pitching coach Andrew Bailey has really had a positive impact early on, both in spring training and the first week of the season. So we'll see how that goes. And then you've got younger players like Sidan Rafaela, who've had an impact early on and I think are exciting players with some speed. Jaron Duran has 5 stolen bases already. So while it might be early to start queuing up for playoff tickets, at least the first week has shown us that maybe there's some entertainment value to be had here, and at least the Red Sox heading in the right direction toward improvement.
Yeah, it's definitely nice to see some of the younger players, because we've gone up to see the Woo Sox, and to see them, it's a fantastic little park. We've interviewed Janet Marie Smith, who helped design that park. Really interesting to see guys like Duran, a big speedster, and Rafaela, Cassis, be able to make an impact on the Major League Ball Club. So I'm hoping that both with some new pitching, they'll be exciting enough where maybe there'll be more wins than you think.
Right. I think that's probably, as realistic a goal as you can have as a fan right now. I don't know that you would put the Red Sox in the class of the Yankees or the Astros or Texas or some of the other more accomplished teams in the American League. But people want to see a path forward. They want to see that, that perhaps this is not going to result in another last place finish after the last two seasons. And I think if people can detect some progress being made, and then you look at some of the prospects in the organization, like Kyle Teal and Roman Anthony and Marcelo Meyer, all probably making an impact in 2025, if not maybe late this year, then you can at least start to imagine what the next great Red Sox team is going to look like.
Absolutely. We want to start to get some of those guys' cards. That's the future catcher, Teal. Hopefully he'll come up to the bigs this year. You had a follow-up, Joe?
What do you think they're going to do with Bobby Dalbec?
Well, for now, Dalbec is a bench guy, a reserve player. He brings them versatility. He can play first base and third base, of course, the two corner infield spots, and he even played some outfield in Worcester last year, so he can contribute there. So there's versatility. What the Red Sox want to see, of course, is more offensive consistency from Dalbec. He has not been able to sustain that kind of performance at the major league level for an extended period of time. He's had his hot streaks, but then just as predictably, there are some cold ones as well. He's had a lot of difficulty making consistent contact. And I think the real challenge for him as he attempts to kind of carve out a spot as a utility guy is to demonstrate that he can produce off the bench when he's not playing regularly. And that's a hard skill for young players to learn, because most outstanding players who reach the big leagues do so playing on an everyday basis. They get into a rhythm. They're playing every day. They can tinker with their swing and know that they're going to be in the lineup the next day and the next day after that. But when you're only playing, first base once a week and maybe coming off the bat to pinch hit for somebody late in the game, you have to learn how to be a contributing player in an irregular role. And that can be hard to learn.
Yeah, that was a great follow-up question. And I think that you hit it on the head, Sean, as far as the rabid fan base. They want to detect that they're trying. We're playing in a division where you got the Orioles on the come. You got the Yankees, 27-time champions. You want to be able to compete, let alone what the West Coast is doing, where they're just pulling in player after player after player, from Freddie Freeman to Mookie, Shohei, etc.
Yamamoto.
And even across town, you see the Celtics are so hungry to try and raise another banner that you can't be complacent in this city. I mean, you got to be able to show that you want to compete. Otherwise, the fan base gets very irritated very quickly.
Yeah, the bar has been set very high in the 21st century between the 6 Super Bowls won by the Patriots, the 4 World Series by the Red Sox, the Stanley Cup championship of the Bruins in 2011, and the Celtics title. So you're right. It's a demanding fan base that is accustomed to seeing the team focused on trying to win it all. And I think that's what frustrates a lot of Red Sox fans, that whether it be judged by activity or payroll size, it seems like there's been a pullback on the part of ownership the last few years, waiting for the team to get to a certain level of competitiveness before they're going to invest further. And I think a lot of fans would like to see more commitment to at least get them back to 500. Then you start integrating some of the younger players into the roster, and then you really kind of go for it with some big additions.
Yeah, as a fan, it's hard to go through full summers of feast or famine. at least keep us in the mix.
Yeah, and there really shouldn't be that great fluctuation of performance for a team with the resources the Red Sox have. You know, you can look at the Yankees and say that they haven't, that they've only won one World Series in the last 23 years or so, but they also have not had a losing season since the early 90s, and they never seem to bottom out in the way that the Red Sox have. And, you know, we talk about the last place finishes in 21 and 22 and 23, but you can also go back to 2020 was a last place finish. 2012 was a last place finish. 2014 was a last place finish. It's happened too often for a team with the resources the Red Sox have. So you'd like to see them ensure that the bottoming out doesn't happen and that a bad year is a bad year like the Yankees had last year at 82-80, not a 70-92 season as the Red Sox have had.
Of course. And they probably could have been a lot better if not for Judge hurting his foot. So
right.
Well, let me ask you this, Sean. The book itself is described as a collection of baseball essays and lesser-known moments in Boston Red Sox history. We're going to dive deep into some Ted Williams questions shortly. But before we do, would you share your process for the research and writing? And then also maybe a few of your favorite lesser-known stories for our very knowledgeable New England audience that listens to the show.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun doing the book, and a little daunting, too, when you look at a franchise that has been around for 120 years, one of the original American League franchises. It was kind of like looking up at a mountain and knowing that you had a very steep climb to make to try to tell the story of the franchise's history. And I made the decision pretty early on in the beginning that I was going to focus mostly on the more modern era of Red Sox history, by which I mean kind of 1967 forward. I think for a lot of baby boomer aged fans in New England, that kind of is the demarcation point where modern Red Sox history begins, the impossible dream season, and then the 75 World Series, the heartbreak of 78, the 86 World Series, and then, of course, the 21st century, which has seen them win four World Series. I didn't think it necessary, and frankly, there was a limit to how much you can cover, as I said, for a franchise that's 120 years old. So most of it was more modern in my lifetime, reflecting my fandom growing up and getting to love the game of baseball and, like many others, going to the ballpark for the first time with my father, some of those memories. So it's really, as I said, I focused more on the modern Red Sox history, but you can't tell the story of the Red Sox without talking about Babe Ruth, without talking about Ted Williams, and without talking about Tom Yawkey, the owner who owned, or he and his estate and family owned the Red Sox from the 1930s up until 2002. So it was almost a 70-year period, and some of the good and bad that came with Yawkey ownership. So those were some of the things I tried to take a look at in the book. And then as you look at the book, it's broken up into a number of different themes. There's one on the aces, which focuses on Roger Clemens and Pedro Martinez, arguably the two greatest pitchers in modern Red Sox history. I talk about the icons, Ted Williams, Carl Yastrzemski, David Ortiz. I talk about what went into constructing the 2004 championship roster and how both Terry Francona and Theo Epstein were mindful of the fact that you needed to have a certain kind of player to succeed in Boston, one that wasn't distracted by the outside noise or thrown off by all the talk about past failures, and then examine how each of the four championship teams in this century sort of had their own personality. 2004 was the idiots and cowboy up and some strange personalities from Kevin Millar to Johnny Damon to Manny Ramirez. 2007 was kind of the manifestation of Theo Epstein's dream of scouting and developing. So much of it was homegrown when you look at Appelbon and Lester and Pedroia and players of that ilk. 2013 came in the shadow of course, the tragedy of the Marathon bombing on Patriots Day in 2013. And then 2018, arguably the greatest Red Sox team in history, won to win 108 games in the regular season and then steamroll three very good teams in the postseason. So I break down all four of the championship teams and examine, you know, what was their common thread, but also what separated the four.
That's really interesting. Yeah. Some of those personalities that are able to block out the noise. Do you have a player or two that meets that criteria that you think suited Boston perfectly?
I think a lot of those guys in 04 were able to, dismiss the, are you going to choke this time and what's going to happen? And, you know, the sort of fatalism that Red Sox Nation had for so many years, expecting the worst, because so often that's what had happened, whether it was falling short in 67, 75, 78, 86. So many times they were teased. They get to game seven of the World Series and can't quite wrap it up. So I think in putting that roster together, you had guys that weren't interested in rehashing what had happened years prior. In fact, in some cases, before they were born, You had Damon and Millar, I think, are sort of emblematic of those, that kind of character, where they knew how to keep things loose. They knew how to live in the moment. They had permission from their manager to sort of be themselves and not be afraid to show their personality. And I think all those things came in very handy in that postseason in 04. When they got down 0-3, there wasn't this throw in the towel thing and, you know, no one's ever come back. They were just going to go out and win one game at a time until they came back and won.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that Millar, a perfect example. I followed him back when he was with the Marlins. He's done some shout out messages to Joseph and I, and he's just a unique, really cool personality. And very matter of fact, I mean, you can see where that idiots kind of comes from, where it's just one of those things where he keeps things very light and airy, and but yet is a real great performer. And if you stay loose, you never know. You mix that with the right amount of confidence, and you can come back and do some amazing things in sports.
Yeah, and it helps to have, as that 2004 team did, a number of real front of the rotation starters like Pedro, like Curt Schilling. They finally had a closer to lock things down in Keith Foulke. That's what had been missing the previous year when the Red Sox lost in the ALCS to the Yankees. So they sort of surgically attacked the holes on the roster after 2003 and deepened the starting rotation, locked down the ninth inning, and had enough talent with two great hitters like Manny Ramirez and David Ortiz kind of leading the way in the middle of that lineup.
Absolutely. Now, your other book is about Boston. It's America's Best Sports Town. Now, we're Red Sox and obviously Boston Celtics fans. We love the passion, the rich history. It's our neighborhood. If you look at L.A. and Chicago, New York, in a brief sentence or two, what makes you feel that Boston is the best sports town?
Well, I think the passion that the fans feel for all four of the franchises, the fact that all four of the franchises were sort of part of the beginning of their respective leagues. The Red Sox had, they were a legacy franchise at the start of the American League. The Patriots were on the ground floor of the old American Football League, thanks to Billy Sullivan's investment and tireless work on the franchise's behalf. The Celtics have a long tradition dating back to the origins of the NBA, and the Bruins were an original six franchise. So, taking nothing away from some of those other cities, the same can't be said for some of those places. And then you think about, the iconic superstars that have played. You can't tell the story of basketball without mentioning Bill Russell, and go back to those great Celtics teams of the 60s and 70s or even the 50s with Bob Cousy and Sam Jones, and then on to John Havlicek and Dave Cowens and Larry Bird, of course, and Robert Parrish and Kevin McHale. Same with the Bruins, whether it be Eddie Shore or Milt Schmidt or Bobby Orr. They had transcendent, instantly recognizable stars. They play in, or did play at one time, in these historic facilities, whether it's the old Boston Garden or still Fenway going strong. And the fan fervor where people live and die with their teams around here. And, you know, it might be a cliche to dismiss some West Coast cities as fair weather and just, you know, following sports is something you do when it's not a sunny day to go to the beach. But it's different around here. As you know, people invest a lot emotionally and financially in following their teams. And I just thought that the combination of the history of the teams, the number of iconic players for all the franchises, and the success that they've had and the fan interest put Boston above all those other cities, frankly.
Very well said. Joseph, why don't you pitch us your second question?
My dad and I podcasted last year with 2004 World Series champion Lenny DiNardo. As a lifelong fan and journalist, did you ever think the Red Sox would win a World Series? And what memories do you personally have of celebrating that epic accomplishment?
Yeah, there were definitely times when I was younger when I wondered whether I would ever see a World Series championship at Fenway Park or involving the Red Sox. I remember thinking when they traded for Pedro Martinez after the 1997 season, that might be the signal that history was turning a bit. And then, you know, they would go on to add Manny Ramirez and David Ortiz and Curt Schilling and others. But I thought, for so many years, what the Red Sox lacked was that great starting pitching. They always had the terrific hitters, whether it be Williams or Yastrzemski or Mo Vaughn or Wade Boggs. They always had great hitting and great position players, but the pitching was usually not up to par and didn't have that same quality. But I think when they started focusing on approach, you know, on really upgrading the pitching and recognizing how important that was, that was a real turning point. And then, of course, you saw how close they came in 2003, and then their determination to go out and add to that roster. Then you could kind of see that they were headed in the right direction. As someone who covered the team as a sports writer starting in 1989. You drop your fandom. You don't root for the team that you cover. You have to have some objectivity. But I won't lie. I did hope that I would one day be around to cover a championship team involving a championship season involving the Red Sox. And little did I know that I would be fortunate enough to cover four of them in the span of about 15 years. So that was a professional thrill as well as a personal one.
Now, the very night that it happened, 2004, are you covering the team hours after this is happening, or are you able to have a moment with yourself and say, you know what, this is for when I was a kid, and you have a cigar and a scotch, or what are you doing? Are you writing articles?
Yeah, I mean, I'm writing most of the night that night in St. Louis, and just constantly coming up with new angles and post game sidebars and columns and game stories. It's all kind of a blur. But I remember being on the field, interviewing some players after, and being in that clubhouse. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I had become a Red Sox fan as a young boy because my father was a Red Sox fan, and going to games with him. And, you know, it was kind of a bittersweet moment for me because when the Red Sox won in 04, my dad was not around to see it. He had passed a couple of years earlier. So I think a lot of New Englanders, you're thinking about parents and grandparents and friends and relatives who perhaps weren't around to see them finally make it to the promised land. And that was a little wistful and bittersweet. But again, you know, you're on the job, and you're expected to be a professional. And most of my emphasis was on cranking out copy for much of that night.
Of course. Now, if you visit Fenway Park today, maybe even this summer, in a sea of green bleacher seats out in right field, there's one seat that's painted red. It's there to honor their left fielder, number 9, the great Ted Williams. It's located in section 42, row 37, seat number 21. And the red seat marks the longest home run ever hit at Fenway, measuring 502 feet in 1946. You've heard on this podcast, and you maybe have read the story of the straw hat and the fan, Joseph, last name with a B, I believe. We've seen, and you've seen, a lot of batting practice over the years at Fenway. Cold days, beautiful hot summer days, windy days. David Ortiz is quoted as saying he's tried to hit that famous seat using an aluminum bat and hasn't even come close. Is that red seat fact or fiction?
I'm not sure we're ever going to get to the bottom of that. You know, the Red Sox insist that they have preserved that for posterity and that its placement is accurate. I guess we'd have to go back and look at photos from the day, and I believe that there were some that purported to show where the ball landed in the next day's papers in Boston. Until proven otherwise, there are some people. I know that Ortiz is something of a naysayer, and I believe that Mo Vaughn, another great left-handed power hitter in Red Sox history, was doubtful about its authenticity. So whether there's a way to actually go back and 100% certify that, I'm not sure. But for now, it makes a pretty good story.
Absolutely. Joseph, go ahead.
But here's the thing when you think about it. In Worcester last year, Bobby Dalback hit a ball 507 feet off of the train at Worcester Red Sox Stadium.
That was a bomb. The train's going by and it just clips the window.
Yep. I remember hearing about that. I'm usually at Fenway and not at Polar Park, but I remember the night it happened and people tweeting about it and being amazed at the distance that was shown. It happens. Look, there have been home runs that that go 500 feet. I think there have been some tape measure shots hit by Mickey Mantle in the old Yankee Stadium that were supposedly 500 feet. So it's not without precedent.
Yeah.
I think when you're on hand and you look at where the seat is in relation to everything else, it almost seems unbelievable. But let's face it, if there's a guy capable of doing it, it would have been Ted Williams.
Absolutely. Joseph, go ahead and fire up another one.
Speaking of Big Poppy, he's one of my favorite players. My dad bought me his jersey last year when I skipped school and we attended opening day in Boston. I know he wrote the foreword to your book. Mm-hmm. Can you share an experience you had with him?
Oh, I could share a million of them probably, Joseph. I covered his whole career with the Red Sox from 2003 all the way up to retirement in 2016, I guess it was. I don't know that I could think of any one. I just remember that David always reacted to the moment. He welcomed the big moment. And that's another thing going back to 2004 when I talk about the different personalities. You know, he wasn't one to buckle under any sort of pressure or expectation. He rose to the occasion as few players ever have. When you look at the numbers he put up in the postseason, particularly that 2013 postseason, and of course, his heroics in 2004, where he had a couple of walk-off hits against the Yankees in the ALCS and just proved to be an unstoppable force. You know, I've talked to him literally thousands of times, so I don't know that I can isolate any one, but it was a privilege to be able to see him perform as he did in those big moments.
Yeah, how does he have such a slow heartbeat? It's just, you know, Minnesota let him get away, and then I know there was the big countryman talk with Pedro, and I just don't know how in such big moments he's able to launch this ball into the sky and in moments that are so needed.
It's a unique skill, and not everyone has it, and not everyone can can do that the way he does. But that's what made Big Poppy Big Poppy, is his ability to just tune everything out, focus on what he needed to do, and come through in a big spot time after time after time.
Just incredible. We're blessed to have been able to see him. Mm-hmm. Well, before my next TED question, we're going to give one lucky fan a custom Blake the Artist Ted Williams card. And this is from our artist friend, Blake Jameson. The Sliders and Curveballs podcast is going to continue to do Pitch Us a Question, social media trivia. We do an all-star home run derby contest where a lot of fans, Sean, will join Joseph. And on television, we'll all try to figure out who's going to win the home run derby. So everybody's kind of a viewing party, if you will. We do mm-hmm. Super Bowl bingo, and with lots of awesome Blake cards that fans are going to love the rest of the year. So to win this one, be the first fan to reach out to us with the keyword or number. And in this particular one, it's going to be 502. So if you're going to be the first one to listen, whether it's on Twitter when we publish this later this week, or on Facebook, or one of my many sports groups that I'm in, 502 will be the magic keyword in honor of Ted's seat. And we thank you so much, Blake, for all of your donations of all your incredible custom cards. Fans are going to be fighting over these, just like they were with the Paul Jenis cards that we gave away for a number of years, with his fantastic Game Within the Game replicas that he did and all the artistry that he did with the portraits. Sean, I know that Ted won the Triple Crown twice and was percentage points away from winning another. He had hit 406. Why do many historians, rightfully so, believe he's the best to ever pick up a baseball bat?
Well, I you know, you started to cite some of the evidence, the fact that he is, that nobody has matched or hit the 400 plateau in the last 80 plus years. And we went, you know, I think probably you've got Mantle winning a Triple Crown, maybe two. After Ted, you have Frank Robinson in 66, Yaz in 67, and then more recently, Miguel Cabrera did mm-hmm. it in Detroit. So you're talking about, you know, four other players have done what he did twice, and no one has done what he did in hitting 400. But in every measurable way, Ted was ahead of his time. When people talk now about launch angle and exit velocity and game plans and going up there with a specific approach, he, after all, wrote a book called The Science of Hitting, and it was very much a science for him because he studied it as few have and understood heat charts and the importance of pulling the ball and finding a good pitch to hit, all the things that are still preached, you know, some... 65 years after his retirement. So that tells you what sort of impact he had on the game and the art of hitting, or science of hitting, if you will. I mean, to think that he hit, you know, 521 home runs and missed parts of, you know, four or five other seasons, which certainly would have gotten him closer to, if not over, 700 home runs, the number of batting titles, his on-base percentage for his career, his OPS for a career, any statistical measure that you want, whether it be on-base ability, batting average, power, doubles, homers, walks, he has set the standard, and nobody, even in his wake, has come close to matching that.
Yeah, just incredible. And I was telling Joseph about the other day, I think we were on the way to a basketball game, and I said, who do you think the greatest hitters of all time are? And he mentioned a few names, but he didn't go all the way back, you know, into the 40s. And then I said, I think you skipped a couple. And I said, the first Red Sox fan that we see inside the basketball stadium there, we're going to ask him who the best are. And of course, the name Ted Williams came up immediately. Sure. And yeah. I think you owe me $5, right, Joe? All right, Joseph, go ahead with what's your next one?
The last one, actually, for me. And then you have your last one. If I take a few weeks off from my practice, my swing or jump shot can get rusty. Ted Williams missed a couple seasons because he served as a fighter pilot in the war. How did he do that?
Well, if anybody had an answer to that, Joseph, I think some others would have figured it out by now, and yet obviously they haven't. I mean, some of it was just God-given ability. He would talk about specific things like being able to see the stitches and spin on the ball. His eyesight was better than 20/20, if you can imagine that. A lot of it was natural talent, but let's give credit where it's due. A lot of it was hard work. And he put an enormous amount of energy and time and everything else into studying hitting. He wrote a book about it that is still kind of the Bible for hitting coaches and people trying to learn how to hit a baseball. It is probably the hardest thing to do in sports, hitting a baseball, and yet Williams did it better than almost anybody. I don't know that I could tell you how, and I'm not sure he could either, but it was probably some cocktail of great God-given ability and dedication and competitiveness and insistence that he was going to be the best. You probably heard the quote that someone said, how do you want to be remembered? And he said, I want people to see me walking down the street and say, there goes the greatest hitter of all time. It's hard to take issue with that when you look at his accomplishments.
Absolutely. Well, we're so honored that you would you'd join us to kick off the Major League Baseball season. Thank you so much. I'm going to finish with 7 fastballs if I can. So we're not going to throw you any off-speed stuff. No sliders and curveballs here. And Joseph, you know what? I asked you a couple of these, I think, before the show, but we'll let you chime in on the first couple as well. So we'll start with Sean first. Aside from the Dodgers, what is the team to fear the most this year?
I think actually the Atlanta Braves are probably almost as talented, if not as talented, as the Dodgers. They don't have Shohei Ohtani. They may not have Mookie Betts, but top to bottom and pitching staff and bullpen, I think they're as talented as anyone. In fact, I picked the Braves to upend the Dodgers in the NLCS, and I picked the Braves to beat the Orioles in the World Series. So my choice for 2024 is the Atlanta Braves.
Okay, fantastic. And that was my prediction. So I'm with Sean and Joseph. Your uncles are going to love you on this. They say that you're a closet pinstripe fan, but so what did you come up with?
I said the Yankees because Aaron Judge is in a slump right now. He's not been hitting the ball well as he did last season. But once he finds his those sweet spot of the ball, he'll be hitting a lot out. And with Juan Soto, they'll combine for probably over 120 home runs a season just from them.
Wow, that's a lot. So they're going to hit 120 between them. I think Soto and Judge are going to be a terror in 2024. You're right. But I'm not sure that the Yankees have the depth with some of the injuries that have already struck. Losing DJ LeMahieu is going to hurt. Trying to keep older players like Anthony Rizzo on the field is going to be a challenge. Losing Gerrit Cole for the first 2 months plus out of the season is a big loss. And I just question whether they have a strong enough rotation to win that division. I did pick them as a wild card. I don't think they're going to have a bad year. I just don't see them winning the pennant or going to the World Series.
And then you look at a team like the Diamondbacks, they seem to have done pretty well to try and continue to keep things moving, which is why I was a little bit disappointed that when the Red Sox lose Gelato, how do you not all of a sudden wake up and see that maybe they grabbed Snell or Montgomery? That was the thing that gets my blood boiling a little bit.
Yeah, I think you're probably not alone among Red Sox fans who thought that was the perfect entree for them to expand the payroll and go out and replace Giolito with either Snell or Montgomery. Ultimately, they decided not to, and we'll see how costly that decision turns out to be.
Of course. All right, well, how about this one? Does Alex Cora's future in Boston depend on this year's record?
To a degree, certainly. I think it's probably one of several factors that will go into the mix. A lot of it will be what kind of working relationship does he develop with Craig Breslow. They're working together for the first time, obviously, so there's a feeling out process and getting to know one another. But certainly how they perform this year with Breslow around and watching the team and seeing how they respond to Cora will be a factor. I know he said yesterday that he likes that that not only is Cora a good in-game strategist, but that he's gotten buy-in from the players and the pitching staff, and that's what's gotten them off to a pretty good start here. So I think we have to wait and see how that relationship develops, but certainly their performance will be one of the things that goes into trying to determine whether he comes back or not.
If you had to take a guess, will a decision be made on Cora sometime during the season, or will he go through the entire season without knowing?
I think it'll be at the end of the year. I think Breslow wants to have as big a sample size as he can. It's not anything that he needs to decide right now. Cora has repeatedly said that he's okay kind of having that lame duck status in 2024. So I think once we get going and the season really takes on its own rhythm, the questions about Cora's future will kind of be put to the side until the end of the year.
And so if you don't know this already, Joseph, this is Cora's last contract year, so he's not sure if he'll be the coach thereafter, or if, who knows, maybe a future guy like a Veritek or somebody else will come in and get involved with things. You know, catchers usually make good coaches, but they all need experience, and Cora has obviously been proven. How about this one? How many World Series rings will Mookie Betts have when he finally retires?
Well, he's two and counting right now, right? 2018 with the Red Sox and 2020 with the Dodgers. That's the hard thing. You know, it isn't easy to win a World Series. Often the best team or the best team doesn't win. We saw that last year with two surprise teams getting in, Texas and Arizona, a couple of teams that kind of were right on the edge in that final week of the regular season and just barely qualified, and then they got hot and went all the way. So it's not always that the most talented team wins. We've seen that time and again. On paper, the Dodgers look like the best team in the game, if not one of the two best teams in the game, but they have had difficulty getting that to translate into championships. They did win in 2020, but that has something of an asterisk next to it because it was the pandemic season of only, you know, 60 games or so. And many people think that signals that it wasn't a legitimate title. We'll let others decide that. But I think the Dodgers are positioned to win a couple of more here in the next few years. They've got huge star power with Freeman and Betts and Yamamoto and Otani and others, and they've got a great pipeline of young players ready to supplement the roster. So on paper, you would expect at least a couple of more, but it isn't easy.
And he's also transitioning from the outfield into the infield as well. Joseph, what are you thinking before we started the podcast? Your number was four for Mookie? Did you think he's going to get two more? I think that's a pretty safe bet.
I'd say that's probably a good number. Having won two already, he could certainly win two more.
And I think Dodgers fans should be a bit greedier than that, because two probably just isn't enough with the amount that they've committed. You probably want more towards six.
That's right.
Who were your favorite Red Sox players growing up yourself there, Sean?
I was a big Yaz fan. 67 was my introduction to the game. And of course, he had the Triple Crown season and going to the World Series. So Yaz was always a favorite of mine. And then a little bit later, Fred Lynn. I just thought he was a terrific player and was sad that he was not given the opportunity to finish his career in Boston. I think it would have transformed his career. We know that he was a guy who knew how to take full advantage of being a left-handed hitter at Fenway, use the wall to his advantage, great plays in center field. So those would have been my two favorites growing up.
That's great. For me, it was probably Dwight Evans, and then I was a big Fred Lynn fan as well. Mm-hmm. Just remarkable in the outfield, the catches that he made.
Yep.
Super exciting. And Jim Rice, he was a lot of fun to watch. Him.
Yeah, it was a great outfield.
Mattingly, those years were fun to see.
Yep.
What's the greatest non-postseason Red Sox game you've ever seen?
I would probably say Pedro's performance at Yankee Stadium, where he struck out 17, gave up the solo home run to Chili Davis. I think that was in 99 or 2000, maybe 98, 99, one of those years. The Red Sox weren't particularly competitive that season. The Yankees were an absolute wagon. They were in the middle of winning whatever it was, 4 and 5 years or 3 and 4 years, and Pedro treated them like they were a double-A lineup. He gave up the one hit. That was the home run to Chili Davis, but he struck out 17. I don't think he walked a single batter. That, to me, was Pedro at his absolute prime, just toying with a great team and lineup, and it was fun to watch that.
Incredible. Do you have any personal game day traditions or routines when you go to the ballpark to cover the team?
Not really. I mean, not to sound clinical about it, but that's work and it's my office. So, I mean, I have a routine of kind of leaving the house at the same time, knowing how long it's going to take to get into Boston and park and get into the ballpark and be ready to work. But you kind of get into a rhythm once the season starts where it's mostly night games. You do what you have to do in the morning and early afternoon with errands and chores and things around the house, and then know that, by 1:30 or quarter or two, it's time to head in, and it's going to be kind of a long work day, and I won't be back until after 1 o'clock most nights. But, even though you see things different at the ballpark almost every day, there's a sameness to, the commute and the travel and the routine that is involved with going to work, just like anyone going to an office 9 to 5. Just so happens my office is the press box at Fenway.
Yeah, I envy you, as I'm sure most fans do. Do you ever pinch yourself and say to your younger self, "Wow, I work at Fenway Park, and when I worked in Washington D.C., I used to drive by the Washington Monument like it was a stop sign." But when you think to yourself, I grew up rooting for this team and look what I get to see every day, it's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it is. And I try to remind myself of that from time to time. You can get a little, I don't want to say spoiled, but you can forget that this is really a pretty unique job that, as you said, a lot of people would give anything to have. So I realize that I'm fortunate to do it. And there are definitely moments, whether it be in the postseason when they're competing for a World Series or a pennant, and you're taking in the atmosphere and you kind of just stop and think a little bit, that not many people get to do what I do. And I recognize that.
Do you have any advice for a young aspiring sports writer or journalist in the current climate where athletes are starting to take very much full opportunity to tell their story, getting on their own podcasts like the Kelce brothers, for example, or they're starting to get with Jeter's platform and tell their own stories, and you start to see what's happened with stuff like Sports Illustrated, etc.? What do you think journalism is like going forward in the next, when Joseph starts to head towards college?
Yeah, it's evolving all the time. It certainly has changed a great deal since I began back in the 1980s. This is my 36th year covering the team. I've done it for a number of different platforms. I've done it for a traditional newspaper. I've done it for a regional sports TV network. I've done it for some digital sites. So I've seen it evolve myself. I've seen social media and how that's changed. My advice to young aspiring journalists is always the same. Take an opportunity to write whenever you can, whether it's a blog for yourself, whether it's a school paper, whether it's a small town paper. Get clips, by which I mean get the experience of writing and polishing your craft and getting better at reporting and writing. And just kind of put your head down and keep going forward. In a lot of ways, the media world has changed. Newspapers have certainly been ravaged. They're not nearly as many, not nearly as prevalent as when I started out. But by the same token, there are a lot of online platforms that didn't exist either. So there are always places where your work can be showcased. And for young aspiring journalists, I advise them to take every opportunity to improve, to get better, and know that good work will eventually be discovered.
That's great advice. Thank you. Joseph, you look at Tyler Kepner, who we've interviewed multiple times. He's actually the only returning guest to our show. It's remarkable how how great his memory is on all things World Series. You name a World Series, he could tell you the pitching matchup.
I know that Tyler can name the starting pitcher of every World Series game since whenever.
Joseph has had him in the studio on his way up to pick up his daughter in college, and he has quizzed him just throwing out random years and random games. And it's unbelievable.
It is.
And we've talked to him about his multiple books. And the fact that his paper basically shut down the sports division, and then he goes over to another place, it just goes to show you how transformational this industry can become. And though Joe has done 75 podcasts now since he was 7 years old, everybody from Jim Calhoun to Lenny DiNardo, lots of media, lots of athletes, et cetera, lots of authors, it's tough to tell what the future will hold in regards to storytelling, which we love to do.
Yeah, and that's really, it doesn't matter the medium or the media or how you're doing it or for how many people. It really is a storytelling job. And, regardless of size of audience or where it's being published or where it's being shown, that part of the job doesn't really change.
Understood. Well, thank you so much. And then the final question is, this is a Pitch Us a Question from our winner. It's going to be David Tucker Moran. He wanted to know, he's going to win one of the Blake the Artist cards for pitching this one. And we'll let you answer, Sean. If Ted Williams didn't miss any of those seasons by serving in the military, do you think he would have surpassed Babe Ruth's home run record?
My guess is probably not, because as great a hitter as Williams was, he was not the type to hit 50 plus home runs in a season. He was a discriminating hitter. We know that based on all his walks and his ridiculous on-base percentage, both in some in many seasons, which were well over 400, and that for his career as well. I mean, he was more of a 35 home run guy. So mm-hmm. even if you multiply out 5 times 30 or so, you probably get closer to 700, but I don't know that you top Ruth. But then again,
who knows what the chase would have done.
right. The doubles, the RBI, the slugging percentage, all the other measurements. It isn't just about home runs, although he clearly would have had well into the 600s if he hadn't missed as much time as he did. Whether he would have topped Ruth, my initial off-the-top guess is probably not. But then when it comes to hitting, I think we've learned that there's very little that we should put past Ted Williams.
Well, the splendid splinter, he's definitely something to treasure. And if you get a chance, kids, to go back and look at YouTube videos and things like that, or read Sean's book or even Ted's book, it'll really give you some really interesting insights into to hitting. We were talking to Lindsay Barra, Yogi's granddaughter, with her great documentary. And they were talking about how amazing of a bad ball hitter he was and how he had missed time in the military as well. Mm-hmm. And it's fantastic to just imagine what they could have done if they just constantly stayed with their profession. But sometimes there's little interruptions to life and there's bigger causes, and we'll just have to appreciate them for the time that they were on the field.
Absolutely.
Well, we wanted to thank you so much, Sean. We look forward to digging into the book and the essays, and we want to wish you a wonderful time covering the Red Sox this year. Hopefully they'll keep it interesting and continue to make month after month a competitive environment where New England can be proud of them. Thank you for taking the time to spend with father and son learning sports together. And we'll definitely check in with you, and I will text you when we're at the ballpark.
I'd love to be able to say hi in person. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it, and good luck with the podcast.
Thank you so much. We'll see you at Fenway. Take care.
Will do.